On a previous episode of Ideas in Development, Anton Korenek made the point that even if AI progress ground to a halt today, we would still spend years uncovering the benefits, figuring out how to integrate them into our workspaces, into our day-to-day lives. The pace of innovation and progress in AI has been truly rapid, but there is a gap between this innovation and real-world impact, between the technological frontier in Silicon Valley and other communities in the United States and other countries in the world. Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev.
And I'm Dina Musa, a researcher and grantmaker at Coefficient Giving. Today, we'll be talking about how new technologies tend to spread across the world and what we can learn from historical case studies when thinking about AI. Economists have long studied the process of technological diffusion, whether that's how jobs in tech spread across the US or how innovation globally responds to the emergence of new hubs like China. Josh Lerner, a professor at Harvard Business School, has researched exactly these questions and joins us this episode. Josh, welcome to Ideas in Development.
Well, thank you so much.
Before getting into your research, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you came to study technology diffusion. Why were you especially interested in this topic?
Well, one reason, I guess, is that I had studied with the master of the economics of diffusion while in grad school, who was Zvi Grelkis. And in particular, Zvi's thesis was turned into a famous econometric paper, which looked at the spread of hybrid corn around the United States and the various agricultural regions. And one of the things that Zvi discovered is even though this hybrid corn was much better than traditional corn, the process of its spread was really quite slow. And while there are a few places like Iowa where it went really rapidly, in many other places, the process of diffusion, even for something where we would think it was a very simple thing to just simply plant hybrid corn relative to regular corn, ended up being a major, major challenge. And that probably planted the seed of my interest in this question. But I think more personally, you know, much of the work that I've done has focused in on venture capital and the process of how venture clusters and venture regions grow. And this has been one of the, you know, big challenges for policymakers around the globe. In particular, I wrote a long time ago, a book called Boulevard of Broken Dreams, which described how governments had struggled in many places to try to create clusters of venture activity to clone Silicon Valley, as it were, and to create vibrant activity. And since then, I've had the opportunity to not only, you know, study many of these cases, but also work with a number of governments who have tried to do this process of transplanting these kinds of high-tech clusters, and really got a chance to appreciate how hard this process really is. And it really underscores what a big issue diffusion is and how much we don't yet understand about what is the process by which it works and how to speed it up.
And when we're thinking about the diffusion of technology across economies, I guess a good place to start is why this innovation tends to be so geographically concentrated in the first place. Could you talk us through some of the kind of key economic reasons behind that geographic concentration?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question as to why this is. And, you know, going back to the work in the 19th century of Marshall, who talked about regional agglomerations, some of the same explanations very much bear fruit. So the idea of saying that if you have suppliers in a given place, it's much easier to do innovation there. So we think about a place like Shenzhen, right, where there's just such enormous capabilities of people in terms of manufacturing microelectronics and many other kinds of things. And it's not surprising that that's emerged as a hub for innovation in robotics and many other areas. Another effect is clearly one of clustering and the notion that workers being in the same place, exchanging ideas, researchers exchanging ideas, that the whole becomes bigger than the sum of the parts. You know, another factor we think about, maybe self-importantly is academia, and that it seems that there are certain places and certain schools which have become extremely powerful as places to help faculty and students commercialize ideas, and this has a big impact on regional economic development. And the last thing seems to be capital, and in particular, the subspecies of capital that I've spent much of my life looking at, namely venture capital, which is divided extremely unevenly around the globe, but in the places where it concentrates, it tends to lead to a flurry of entrepreneurial activity. Yet.
And has research suggested that one of those in particular is kind of the standout most important reason, or does it seem to be kind of a mixture of these different factors?
Well, I think one of the big challenges in terms of doing a definitive kind of answer is that it's just really hard to run an experiment here, right? That, you know, were I in charge of a Harvard endowment, I could go and give $1 billion to people running funds in Topeka, Kansas, and see whether we see some big boost in entrepreneurial activity. But it's pretty hard to run those kind of experiments in real life. And in many cases, one does have this sort of coevolution. You know, when you think, for instance, about the growth of Silicon Valley and the role that, you know, the leadership at Stanford played in facilitating that process, you know, the federal government, which was eager to have defense capabilities on the West Coast as well as on in the Northeast, the role of some of the early financiers, angel investors who ended up, who in many cases had been entrepreneurs before they became funders. There's a whole confluence of things that came together, and really untying that Gordian knot and really figuring out what really is the secret sauce remains pretty challenging.
And so you have this research that's focused on kind of technology in the United States over a period spanning decades. What are the new technologies that you study in this work, and how are you trying to capture their diffusion across the United States?
Well, you know, our motivation in doing this when we first thought it up was not that people hadn't looked at diffusion before. We already mentioned Zvi's work on hybrid corn, and there's certainly been lots of other things doing in terms of spread of computing capabilities, you know, broadband, even, you know, looking at the spread of encyclopedias in, you know, the Middle Ages as ways to look at diffusion. But the vast majority of the literature had taken the approach of saying, let's look at a single technology and look at the process by which it diffused and learn some interesting things about that. And our notion was to say, could we exploit some of the tools that are out there to essentially look at not one, not 10, not even hundreds, but you know, really thousands of different technologies in the process of diffusion that they had, and try to understand the more general patterns that took place across this very wide range of technologies, some of which are really quite important, like mobile phones and AI, and others of which are extremely narrow and remain, you know, very much niche things in particular sectors.
And in this work, you focus on jobs. I guess in an ideal world, would there have been another kind of hallmark or measure of diffusion that you would have liked to have used? Or, yeah, was jobs kind of the best you had?
Well, I think that jobs are pretty fascinating, right? On the one hand, we care about them, right? They're really important. And in particular, when it comes to, you know, when we think about so much of discussion around a new technology like AI today, so much of it is couched in the terms of jobs, you know, what are being created, what are jobs being destroyed, and the like. So certainly jobs are an important measure. The other great advantage that jobs had is that it's extremely micro in the sense that we can look at the level of individual job announcements and looking at how they're describing the position that's there, and in particular, looking at to what extent are they referencing these new technologies. So as opposed to something like productivity, which we know is hard to measure in the economy as a whole, much less in specific sectors, and even there, you're probably going to have to cast your aperture pretty widely to get measures. here we have these super high grain micro observations, not just simply at the level of the individual regions, but at industries and even at the level of companies. Where are jobs being created that involve these new technologies?
So, Josh, a big question of the moment. How relevant do you think findings on past technologies are for AI? Do you think AI will follow the same sorts of patterns that you document for other technologies?
Well, I think that in some sense, you can say there is a bunch of stuff that we saw across technologies in general that seems to be very clear for AI as well. In fact, in some ways, you could argue AI is perhaps even more extreme than the typical case. One of those things relates to geographic concentration. And in particular, when we look at the process of the typical new technology, you see it starting off being very concentrated. And while jobs do spread out over time, particularly if you look at the high-end jobs, the research and well-paying product development jobs and so forth, they remain super concentrated, not just for a few years, but for multiple decades afterwards. That's a very gradual process of spreading out the good jobs, right? And you know, the analogy I sometimes like to use is that of the mobile phone, right? There's lots of jobs at Verizon stores and tech support setting up people's phones, but you say, where are the really good jobs related to mobile phones? A lot of them are sitting, you know, in Apple headquarters designing the next generation of iPhone and so forth. So the general pattern of concentration is something that is very clear, is something that we see in AI as well. For instance, if you think about venture capital as a whole, you know, roughly half the money has been invested in recent decades in the United States, and roughly half of that has been in San Francisco or the Bay Area. If you look at AI investing in 24, which is the last year that the Stanford Group on AI put together the estimates for, their estimate is that somewhere on the order of 65% of the money went to the U.S., and the lion's share of that money went to companies based in San Francisco. So we're seeing that sort of, again, this very intense concentration of stuff at the hub, not just for 1 or 2 years, but for an extended period of time. Now, that still doesn't really answer the question of whether that will continue in the future. And for that, clearly, we need a crystal ball. But certainly, one does get a sense that much of the initial dynamics, at least, have a lot of similarities to that we've seen for, you know, the many other disruptive technologies that have been there in the past.
So turning to your work on the rise of China as this global hub of innovation, I was wondering whether you could first kind of talk us through what that actually means in practice. What does it mean for China to be a global hub of innovation?
Well, certainly it's the case that if you looked at, for instance, venture capital as an indicator and said, where is venture capital investment being made? And went back in time to the beginning of the 21st century, to 2001, essentially what you would have seen is that essentially 85 cents of every dollar invested in venture capital went to the U.S. Of the remainder, most of it went to Europe or Australia or Japan. In other words, major industrialized powers. And the stuff that was left over for everything else, basically the entirety of the emerging economies, was only on the order of 2 or 3%. And what's happened in the ensuing years was this incredible growth of venture activity outside the United States, and in particular with the growth being concentrated in China, so that if you fast forward to, you know, probably the high watermark of the Chinese venture industry of around 2019, it was almost the same size or share of investment as that in the United States. So we just saw this sort of explosion of entrepreneurial activity, high potential entrepreneurial activity out of nothing in China in a way that really has been unprecedented in the history of the, you know, venture industry, and I think in a lot of other measures as well. And clearly, if you look at other metrics like scientific papers or corporate R&D spend, one's seen not in quite as dramatic form, but one's seen much of the same kind of activity taking place. And an important thing to emphasize is that I think many people, when they think of, you know, Chinese, you know, there's at least initial reaction of saying, oh, they must supposed to be copycatting what's being done in the U.S. and they're taking Uber and basically just applying that idea here. This isn't true innovation. I think that as you look at the kinds of things being done there, one sees that in many cases, even if a problem is still the same, like, you know, oh, what about mobile payments or transport and so forth, there has been a lot of business model innovation in terms of taking ideas and approaches that, you know, that were really suited for the Chinese climate in particular and putting them to work there.
And one of the really interesting findings of this research you do on China is that it has actually led to a substantial increase in emerging market entrepreneurship outside of China. So kind of China becoming this global hub has had a bunch of knock-on positive impacts on these other countries. What was the channel through which that kind of positive spillover effect has happened?
That's a great question. I mean, so certainly it seems in the data, and we try to do a lot of things to, you know, address, you know, identification concerns and so forth, that there is very much a pattern where the emergence of China as a sort of this hub for high potential entrepreneurship did serve as a stimulus for entrepreneurship in many emerging economies as well. And in some sense, that's very logical, right? In the sense that, you know, if you think about many of the problems that, you know, entrepreneurs in China faced, whether it was doing delivery in a setting where, you know, getting it to the last mile was very challenging, right? Because just the physical infrastructure just wasn't necessarily that good or addresses that easy or anything along those lines. Whether you think about, you know, trying to do with payments in a world where most people didn't necessarily have credit cards. And as a result, a lot of the financial infrastructure that we've relied on, you know, we take a second nature in the States, wasn't really there. The idea that there would be a second approach or a second way of doing things that was in some ways in an environment which was much, much more similar to those of other emerging economies, it's not surprising in some level that that served as a sort of stimulus. How this process worked, though, is a really interesting question. And you might think, you know, start off with is this must be just a story of Chinese venture firms going and investing in other places and taking their business ideas and putting them to work. There's a little bit of that which has taken place, but by and large, that doesn't seem to be the most important element. Instead, it seems that much of the emulation of Chinese entrepreneurial business models that's taken place has actually been funded by local venture capitalists being done by local entrepreneurs rather than, you know, Chinese transplants who came in and did these things. How did those people learn about it? That remains a really interesting question. You know, we did as part of this effort a series of case studies, just looking at some of the individual companies and what their trajectories were. And in some cases, you saw stories where, for instance, you know, an entrepreneur in sitting in Brazil ends up going and doing some sort of internship in China and gets exposed to this notion of social commerce or group buying and says, that would really work in Rio as well. I need to do a few things differently, but let me take this idea and try it. In other cases, you've seen examples where you've had, you know, venture capitalists who have really positioned themselves as translators. You know, so for instance, a VC sitting in Singapore, who's of Chinese ancestry and has still connections there, who identifies some interesting trends and says, I bet I can try to make this work in Indonesia or Malaysia, and basically it serves as the sort of transportation mechanism. So in a way, it's hard to pin down one thing as the crucial mechanism, but it does seem that this you know, power of example or role model seems to have been a really important aspect of it.
So from a policy perspective, it's striking that local investors play such a crucial role. How can they be supported to do this at a greater scale? And what are some of the bottlenecks that the government could alleviate for them?
That's a great question, Dana. And, you know, if I wish I could sort of boil it down to one thing that is the magic formula. I do think, though, that, you know, while there isn't one simple answer, there are several things that seem to be very much associated with the creation of a successful risk capital environment. I think the biggest one is essentially trying to remove the barriers and impediments that are there. I think in a lot of cases around the world, the governments are almost immediately tempted to say, let's go and throw a lot of money at people trying to do angel funds or venture funds or whatever, without necessarily addressing the barriers which are there. And what do we mean by barriers? In some cases, it's technology transfer policy, which make me very hard to get things out of a university. In other cases, it's labor policies, right, where it becomes hard to fire anyone, which makes it very hard as an entrepreneurial business to hire anyone, since you don't know whether things are going to work out or whether you're going to need to pivot. In other cases, we know that the process of business registration and getting traction along those lines can be really substantial. And, you know, of course, one of the reasons why governments often don't jump into these areas is that this is often a very non-glamorous process of doing the cleaning up or removal of these impediments. And in many cases, changes to the treatment of stock options or labor or whatever, you know, it starts stepping on other people's toes and can be inherently kind of controversial. But in some sense, if one doesn't do those initial steps of addressing these kinds of things, just throwing money at the problem is unlikely to be successful. You know, one of the dramatic illustrations along these lines was the efforts that the Japanese government did in the 1990s and early 2000s to encourage venture capital activity in Japan. They shoved a ton of money into various programs to back entrepreneurs, venture firms, and so forth, and created what seemed like a very vibrant venture industry, but really didn't address the many structural things that made it incredibly hard to be an entrepreneur in Japan. And once the austerity hit and they had to dial back the tap on the government money to the venture funds, the whole industry activity really subsided, that it was basically just really being propped up by the government funds, and that the environment itself at that period was just really not conducive to being an entrepreneur in Japan. The other thing that I think is really important is the notion of matching funds, or trying to essentially, rather than as a government official, try to pick out what the winning areas are yourself, instead having the private sector, you know, provide clues or indications as to where the opportunities really lie. And again, you can think about many examples of both where governments went wrong by saying, we just want to jump on this bandwagon, even though it just didn't really make very much sense for what they were doing. And we can certainly talk about some examples along those lines, but also ones where that matching fund kind of approach has been quite successful. I think the most famous example there being that of the Yozma program in Israel, which created in the, you know, early 90s, you know, what remains one of the most vibrant venture clusters in the Tel Aviv Herzliya area, which basically worked by essentially investing alongside foreign venture funds who are willing to commit money and, you know, getting the industry, bringing an influx of expertise and, you know, guidance from, you know, sophisticated investors worldwide.
Yeah, you mentioned a few different types of players, including government and investors. I'm curious what you think the role is here for development finance institutions.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So certainly it's fair to say that when you look at, you know, much of the venture activity around in the emerging economies around the globe, you could think about a place like Africa as an example, the DFIs, the development banks, have played a really important role in terms of doing it. As a limited partner, they've been, or an investor, they've been willing to take chances on funds that, you know, more financially driven investors, whether a pension fund or an endowment, would be unlikely to invest in, right? And so in theory, this can, these organizations can play an extremely catalytic role in terms of stimulating the creation of a venture sector. Now, again, you know, a lot of the devil is in the details. And in particular, what we've seen in recent years is a trend that I've not been in love with, which is many of the DFIs have tried to do more of the investment, particularly on the equity side, themselves, rather than outsourcing it to fund managers. And I would argue that they're probably much better served, you know, basically trying to create vibrant communities of investors, whether angels or venture groups, rather than investing out of their own balance sheet. Then I think, you know, one reason is, of course, just simply that, you know, incentives matter, and that in a way, what you want is people who are, you know, really motivated to get great financial returns from those investments. But I think it's also that in many senses, you know, the process of choosing which entrepreneurs to back and when to refund and when not to fund is an inherently complicated, subjective kind of process that probably doesn't normally work so well in a government organization where everything has to be documented and justified and the like, and where having the sort of people closer to the ground who are able to make more intuitive kind of decisions work better. So I think that in some sense, absolutely, DFIs have been essential and will continue to be. But on the other hand, I think there are some right ways to do it and some not so right ways to proceed.
Absolutely. And it seems like a lot of the roles and interventions you mentioned seem quite relevant for AI business models too. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question as to how this AI stuff will diffuse, and you know what the pattern will be, particularly not just simply in terms of within the U.S., but also more globally. Certainly today, you know, when you say where are the cutting edge AI companies? Well, we know the vast majority of them are sitting in the U.S. and China, and in part that seems to reflect scale, right? That the one of the things we know about these kind of analytics is that data is extremely important, and being in a big country probably facilitates getting access to a lot of data, and that may explain part of the issue. It's also the case that, you know, many of the most successful companies have required very big checks, where there are, you know, again, large countries are probably easier to raise those kind of very large checks. On the other hand, you know, AI is not just simply a story about large language models or foundational models, right? There's also the issue about taking these tools and figuring out what the applications are and how to create applications that really make sense for the individual context that one's working in, right? So we see, you know, a ton of experimentation, for instance, in terms of AI and healthcare, where the only way to be really effective at doing this is to really understand both the clinical environment, how doctors are working, how insurers play a role, and the like. So you can easily imagine a world where even if the top level, the foundational models, are really largely concentrated in a few global hubs, we're likely to see that the flowering of applications in a lot of places based on the individual contexts that are there. And I think it's fascinating to think about that and how the entrepreneurial market will really evolve there. It's still very early goings, but it seems like there's both enormous opportunities and a lot of uncertainty.
And I guess that kind of links to some of the ideas that you have in your paper on China as this hub of innovation. I guess with those findings in mind, that China kind of helped to facilitate this process of increased entrepreneurship around the world. And given the fact that China is set to, if not lead, at least kind of compete with the US in some aspects of AI innovation, are you feeling, I guess, a bit more bullish about how fast AI will diffuse, given the role that China's set to play in this?
It's an interesting question. I mean, certainly one thing that is striking is just simply the pace of innovation there, right, in many of these applications. So I was in Hangzhou in December, and as part of that, I mean, first of all, it was a little striking that, you know, we've heard all the publicity about, DeepSeek, and I was talking to people saying, you're really excited about DeepSeek, right? And they're like, no, DeepSeek's yesterday's news. Now everyone's using Kimi or the new Alibaba thing, this Cube, you know, right? That there was just this extremely brutal kind of competition there, which we know is something that's likely to translate into a process of rapid innovation. The other thing which was really striking is that the fund I was visiting is doing work in AI and healthcare, and, you know, the speed with which, you know, they were bringing stuff into the clinic in various kinds of applications, obviously with a lot less constraints of rules around data privacy and like that we'd be familiar with in the medical context in either the US or in Europe, was very striking as well. So I do think that it's very hard to, you know, whatever the challenges that China has faced from a macroeconomic perspective, it's very hard to, you know, write them off or say this is that they're unlikely to be a significant player going forward. How the process of diffusion will work and so forth, you know, really remains an open issue. But I do think that it is likely that, you know, both, you know, American firms and Chinese firms, that those ideas will spread out and stimulate a lot of innovation in other places.
So to summarize, when thinking about the lag from AI progress to AI diffusion and actually realizing the gains of the technology, what are the top things that we're getting wrong today about how long diffusion takes and the factors that control that?
Well, I think, you know, we sometimes have this tendency to think about new technologies, revolutionary new technologies, as changing life instantaneously. And I think the one thing we can say from history is that that process is often not nearly as quick a one as we might think, right? And we can go back to areas like electricity, where, you know, Tim Bresnahan and Manuel Trachtenberg and others have sort of highlighted how long it really took for the development of the electric motor to really translate into substantial upticks in terms of productivity. And what were the things that held it back? Well, a lot of the things that held it back were the human factor of just simply really re-engineering and changing the way that production lines work and organizing things in a more Fordist kind of production line approach. So I suspect we will see much of the same dynamics with AI, where even if a technology seems magical, the process of really transforming work in the process of work is likely to be a somewhat slower one, just simply because us as humans are slow to adapt to change. I also think that the geographic patterns we've talked about before, where we are likely to see some regions benefiting a lot more than others, and that even if the technology does spread out, that the initial areas will have a strong comparative advantage, especially when it comes to the best jobs, is something that we're likely to continue to see in this realm as well.
And what metrics do you think we should be focusing on when thinking about how to measure how quickly AI is diffusing as a technology?
Well, I think this is a really interesting thing, is to say, you know, which sort of goes back to your earlier question of saying, why did we just look at jobs? And of course, you know, I had a variety of reasons for why jobs were a good measure. But the other thing is that we can measure a lot more finely jobs than many other metrics. And I think that this does underscore the fact that we would like to be able to look at a lot of different aspects of it, including some things that may be harder to measure. So, for instance, looking at how new jobs are created, it certainly seems like an important thing to look at. But we'd also want to think about the transformation of existing jobs and how AI is affecting how people are doing the things that they may have the same job title, but what they're doing may change quite dramatically. Similarly, we'd also want to look at something that, you know, the work that I described of ours earlier did not really touch about, which is the process of job destruction. And, you know, one of the big challenges, of course, is that it's, you know, the job announcement comes and it's geocoded with a place and a date and a company and so forth. The jobs which are lost may be hundreds of miles away, and it's much harder tracing the technology shock to the loss of a job. And clearly, thinking through how to measure this and try to assess how important the job losses are and what are the trade-offs and so forth very much seems to be an important issue, right? That in some sense, you know, much of the criticism of the policy response to the first China shock, right, was that, you know, people were like, oh, this is going to be great, comparative advantage, without really thinking about all the people in the Rust Belt in the U.S. or, you know, their counterparts in Europe who lost their jobs as part of it, and not trying to address some of the, you know, regional and social unhappiness that transpired as a result. So I think that thinking not just about the, you know, the plus side of a ledger, but also about the other side is going to be a really important part of the equation as well. So one thing which is also an interesting question has to do with the role that universities play in this process, right? That when we look at a lot of parts in the world, certainly in the U.S., there's been a real process of questioning of why has the government been so generous supporting universities if essentially it's just a bunch of, you know, spewing out a bunch of Marxist woke speech as a result. And, you know, one of the things that that discussion obviously ignores is how important universities have been in terms of originating and commercializing much of the critical technology behind industries like internet and biotech and the like. But I think it's important to emphasize that not all universities are equal here, and that there's a lot of heterogeneity across universities in terms of how commercially oriented the faculty are. And in one of our recent works, we looked at what happened to faculty when they moved from a school which did a lot of research but relatively limited commercialization. In the U.S. context, something like Duke, which is a great research university, but where there have been relatively few spin-outs, to a school which has much more commercialization associated with something like Stanford, which may have roughly the same research budget as Duke, but where there's far more spin-outs and startups and venture funding associated with faculty and grad student-based companies. And in particular, one of the things we show is that it seems that place matters a lot, that a professor moving from Duke to Stanford becomes much more commercially oriented in terms of the work that they're doing, and perhaps even more surprisingly, a faculty member that moves from Stanford to Duke becomes less commercially oriented. And that in some ways, obviously, a lot depends on the professor and the area of research that he or she is doing, but around 20 to 25% of the effect seems to be driven by the place where the faculty member is at. And again, that poses a big question for people trying to promote economic development, right? You know, if you're sitting, for instance, in India, you say, let's just spend more money at IITs or IIMs and great things will happen. It doesn't seem to be that simple, right? There's also a set of things that are associated with the process of making a school more commercially oriented that, you know, it's hard to pin down, but it seems incredibly important in terms of encouraging development in advanced technologies.
This has been Ideas in Development. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us 5 stars or a thumbs up wherever you've been listening to us or watching. The best way to make sure that you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And our past episodes, as ever, are available at voxdev.org.